Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. Bob Dylan is now 73, and his music has spanned more than half a century of enjoyment, argument, scholarship, social change, and bewilderment. Often fan interest has crossed the line over to obsession unique to Dylan fans, many of whom think the meaning of life might be buried somewhere on Self-Portrait. In his new book, author David Kinney introduces us to a motley crew of fans and fanatics who retrace Dylan's Greenwich Village steps, travel to Minnesota to see the old Zimmerman place, and collect hours of tape, hoping to find a lost song. The Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist's book is called The Dylanologist, Adventures in the Land of Bob. David Kinney, welcome to The Roundtable.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
As we speak, we are on the eve of Bob Dylan's birthday, and you are in his hometown. What is that like?
It is the downtown, at least, is a lot like it used to be. It's a quiet, you know, North Country old mining town, and tidy streets. I'm sitting in a Victorian house that was built for one of the mining chiefs back in the day. People come up here for this. A couple hundred people come up every year for his birthday for this celebration. And there's a singer-songwriter contest, and you can do this bus tour of the town and see the house where he grew up. You can see the place where he did his bar mitzvah. You can go and see the railroad tracks where he almost was killed by a passing train while he was riding his motorcycle. And you can also just sort of soak up the North Country feel and get a sense of where he came from. And it does color how you listen to, especially the early Dylan. You can sort of hear that in his voice.
Your book opens with one of the occasions when the rumor flew around Hibbing that, hey, Bob's in town. The town seems like it has kind of a wary relationship with him even today.
Well, sure. I mean, for a long time, he was not beloved in Hibbing. You know, I mean, he doesn't necessarily fit in this town, I guess, and he left it. And when he first arrived in New York City, he made up all these stories about where he was from. He said he was from Gallup, New Mexico. He said that he was an orphan, things like that. And so, you know, that didn't play too well in Hibbing, where his parents were sort of a respectable middle-class family. And, you know, over the years he said other things about Hibbing. He said that, you know, it's a good old town is one of the things that he said. He said that, you know, there was something in the air that you could sort of sit there and meditate. And so I think he came around on it. The town is only just sort of coming around on him. And so you can still find people who will tell you that he was, you know, an arrogant, obnoxious kid that, you know, my father wanted to beat up when he was in high school. But there's a small contingent of people who've tried to keep the memory alive and make people realize that Hibbing isn't just the home of, you know, the NBA star Kevin McHale, that, you know, Dylan came from here as well.
You know, Woodstock, Big Pink, that's right down the road from here. So certainly WAMC listeners are familiar with a bit of this. But I kind of wonder, who are these people? You said 200 people are in town. Who are they? What are they like? What are they doing?
Well, you know, the people in they're big music fans is what they are, who, you know, at some point in their life got hooked on Dylan. And, you know, as one writer said, once you sign up for Dylan, you're kind of in for life. You know, so these are people who have gone to see a bunch of shows. These are people who don't just own all the official records, but also own a bunch of bootlegs. They probably read. I met a guy last night who said that he'd read like 18 Dylan books over the course of his life. So, you know, these are people who listen really hard and love the music so much that they want to sort of pull the threads on where it will lead you, and Dylan is perfect for that. I mean, he's drawn from so many different sources musically, from poetry, from literature, from history, and you can follow those threads if you want, and it'll take you down fascinating avenues.
We'll get back to that in a minute because your book has stirred up some of that. But I wanted to ask you first: where do you fall on the Dylanologist spectrum?
I've gotten that question a lot. My answer is that during the two or three years that I was working on this, I was probably, you know, an 11 on a scale of 1 to 10. You know, I saw probably 20 shows, and for a while I was doing anything Dylan-related that I could think of. And so I did go to Big Pink, actually, and hung out in the basement with the new owner there. And I made trips to Dylan academic conferences in New York City and in Vienna. I went to England and hung around with the men who created these Dylan fanzines. And, you know, like I said, followed the tour at one point from Austin all the way up to Sturgis, South Dakota, where Dylan played the big motorcycle rally up there, which was the scene. So, you know, I also read, you know, probably millions of words over the course of 3 years. At one point I had this silly idea that I was going to read in on the topic, and it's just literally impossible. There's just so much that's been written about him. So, you know, but before I started this book, I think I was probably around a five. But during the process, I was definitely over the top.
As best we can tell, what is Dylan's attitude throughout the years and today to the people who have devoted so much time to parsing the language, collecting, you know, scraps of napkin and so on?
Hostility, I think, is the one word. You know, he's said that, you know, they're wasting their lives, or we're wasting our lives, that, you know, you shouldn't spend so much of your life focusing on him. He's lashed out at his critics. He's called them, you know, wussies and pussies. He's you know, spoken in some of the most incendiary language. You know, I think it's difficult. This book is about a relationship between an artist and his audience. And, you know, he's a creative mind, right? So he creates these songs, and he doesn't really necessarily know how he created them. And we turn around and ask him sort of, what does it mean? And, you know, how did you do this? And that sort of thing. And he can't really answer those questions. And so I think he's thrown them back on his audience and left it for them to try and decide what it means to them. It's not important what he was thinking while he was writing these songs. What's important is sort of what they do to you and what you take from them. And so that's been the tension between Dylan and his audience. And I think that's the frustration that he expresses when he says, you know, these people. And also he has the whole, you know, the whole celebrity fame situation where he attracted a whole band of eccentrics who did things like, you know, go through his garbage and come to his house and swim in his swimming pool and things like that. And so that can be, I'm sure that's more than frustrating.
You mentioned one of his more incendiary quotes about his critics, and your reporting has uncovered only the latest example of certain people pointing out where Dylan may have borrowed, maybe plagiarized, depending on how harsh you want to be in the criticism, certainly in his painting, in his songs, and even in the widely lauded autobiography Chronicles, Volume 1. Can you tell us what seems to be there?
Well, I mean, Chronicles is fascinating because he basically could have sat down and written this memoir about his life, you know, and just be done with it. But instead what he did was he did it in much the same way he's done his songs. He drew from other sources. And so there are phrases in there from everything from Jack London to Mark Twain to Time Magazine, stuff from travel guides, stuff from the internet. And there's a former disc jockey in Albuquerque named Scott Warmoth who has been going through Chronicles in recent years and basically annotating it. I mean, he's figuring out what came from where. And then he's also taking the next step. He doesn't think that Dylan's a plagiarist. What he thinks Dylan is doing is you know, it's partially sort of a cut-up technique. But he sees wordplay. He sees allusions. He sees, you know, clever tricks here, and that there's almost a book behind the book if you want to look for it. And that's what he's been doing. And that Dylan's been doing this all his life. I mean, he came out of the folk tradition where you know, took some song that Woody Guthrie played, for instance, and you sang new words over it. Or in, you know, on Highway 61, you can find snippets of old blues lines sprinkled throughout the record. Later records he took from bits of film dialogue. And so this has been a constant throughout his career. And, you know, it's a style, but it's also, there's more to it than that. I think that there's an elusiveness to it, and that's what guys like Scott are trying to unravel and describe.
Hmm. You know, Dylan is approaching his mid-70s now, still touring several months in the year, and it's the never-ending tour and so on. But, you know, mortality catches up with everyone, and eventually there won't be so much new to add to what we know about Dylan. Where do you see this cult of Bob going after his death?
He might outlive us all, right? I mean, he might still be touring when he's 120, for all we know.
Which is okay, by the way. That's fine with me.
Well, what's nice is he's still out there and he's still creating. You know, he's got this new Frank Sinatra cover on his website, and you know, there's word that it's part of a whole album of these songs. Which, you know, what's great is that he's always doing something something different, something new, something unexpected. You know, I think that after, you know, if someday he actually you know, does pass away and leave this earth, I mean, I think it will be. It'll be interesting to see what comes out, you know. So it'll be interesting to see who is now willing to talk about things that they didn't want to talk about when he was still alive. It'll be interesting to see what sorts of recordings that have been held back will come out. You know, that'll be fascinating because there is sort of this sense of that he's still a real guy, that he's still a private person who keeps his private life private, and so a lot of that stuff is still in people's drawers and in people's memories and in journals that they've written but not shared. So it'll be interesting to see what comes out.
Having spent so many years as a Dylanologist to the extreme, do you agree with him that it's been a waste?
I think that argument is insane. I mean, I think the sense that, I mean, we know where the line is. You know, the line is when an interest sort of crowds out everything else in your life, and it turns you into sort of a monomaniacal kind of figure. And I think I didn't really meet people like that. I met people who were serious music fans, who listened to other music, who, you know, had families, who did other things. You know, the people who follow the tour, you could follow 20 shows and go to 20 different cities and see Europe that way. So it's silly to say that listening to Dylan and seeing where it will take you will, you know, is just a waste of time. We all do all sorts of things that are time wasters, but I wouldn't say that this is one of them.
Well, we've been speaking with David Kinney, the author of The Dylanologist, Adventures in the Land of Bob, which is out now. David, thank you so much. It's a great read, and enjoy the conversation very much.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
And you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.
And next full moon, if my one wish comes true, my